And that is the challenge of the world. And if you still think otherwise, you may have lived on this planet for 50, 60 or 70 years and still expect things not to go wrong. Now, the illusion that you can have things not going wrong, you can still live in that illusion if you live in an advanced industrialized country, perhaps. Travel to India, and you can no longer live in the illusion that things around you are solid and that you are in control. You are not. Nothing that you plan is going to work out. Everything is going to be totally different from the way you expected, and things will constantly challenge you, forms, and wherever you look, the world is not as solid as it seems to be here. Wherever you go, there are old people, dying people in the street. Are they not? Where are the old and dying people here? I don't see any. They're shut away. We mustn't look. Just pretend that they don't exist. We put them away there. The old go here, and the dying, we put them there. And the dead bodies never look. You must never see a dead. It's very hard, unless you have a very close relative. If you ever want to see a dead body, they won't let you. They say you're mad. But if you are in India, you see dead bodies very easily. It's normal. And so you get a much better sense of the fragile nature of the world of things, objects, and forms, how insubstantial this world actually is. And it's only in the West that you have the illusion that the world of form is very substantial, solid, and it's going to last. It's there. It has a solidity and a permanency. It doesn't. And when sometimes a gigantic man-made form collapses, like 2 years ago, in New York, that comes as a dreadful shock to people because it looked so solid and it collapsed. So the world of objects isn't as solid as it seems to be. The world of bodies isn't as permanent and solid as it seems to be. It is very, very fragile, fleeting, insubstantial. So if that's all you know, then you are in this fleeting, insubstantial universe, and there's nothing. And of course, there's constant fear when you identify with that. Even though they try to just, it's really very much like the Buddha, because the story goes that he was born into great wealth, and his father did not want him to see that there is poverty, that people grow old, and that people die. So he had already reached fairly advanced age. He was, I don't know, can't remember, 25, 30, whatever, and wasn't really aware that there's such a thing as ill, old, and dying people, because he lived in, this is, seems like almost like the West these days, that's shut away. And one day he saw it. His father didn't want him to see it because it had been predicted he would either become a great king or a great spiritual teacher. And the father didn't want him to become a spiritual teacher. He wanted him to carry on the business of being a king, the family business. And so, but the father had made the biggest mistake he could have made. He waited for so long. When finally he did go out, it was such a shock when he saw that people were lying in the streets dying and ill and old, and he saw dead bodies. He said, "What is this? Does this happen? What happened to this man? He's not moving anymore." He said, "He is dead." "Dead?" "Yes." "And that happens to everyone?" "And what's the point in anything? And soon later, he left everything behind. In the middle of the night, the story goes, when everybody was asleep, and this is a beautiful metaphor, everybody around him was asleep, and he walked out. If that's all there is, so his search then was for that dimension. Is there something else to life than just that? And it lasted a few years. And he tried all the practices, tried to achieve a state of perfection. He got very good at all the practices, and yet they didn't take him to the realization of space consciousness. And one day he almost starved himself to death when he said, "I've had enough." This is my translation of the sutras again. He said, "Enough is enough. Give me some food." And they brought him some food. Most disciples left him. He said, "Oh, he's lost his way. He's eating again." And then he ate normally and he sat under a tree. And suddenly something happened. All resistance collapsed. He was no longer looking for anything to happen. There was surrender to what is, not looking for some state anymore. And there it was. The last thing that, in there's a film, The Little Buddha, which is, has some nice things in it, although it's too much about the legendary Buddha, but there's still beautiful scenes in it. The last thing that disturbs him is when he's sitting under a tree and he sees his reflection in a little puddle of water. Self-reflection. And he sees his face in the little puddle of water next to him, and he's fascinated by that suddenly. And suddenly an arm comes out of this pool of water and tries to pull him down. This is, and he frees himself, and then the reflection is gone. This is the last attempt by the ego to be there as an object in his consciousness, to see himself as someone, to remain there as an object in his consciousness, a mental object, to making himself into a mental, this is normal consciousness, making himself into a mental object and then have a relationship with it. I love myself. I hate myself. Now, do I really hate myself? I must remind myself on the bathroom mirror that I love myself. I love myself. You have a relationship with yourself. Of course, it's better to love yourself than to hate yourself. It makes life a little easier. But when you love yourself, there's always, on the other side, the possibility that you might also hate yourself. Better to go beyond loving and hating yourself by not having a relationship with yourself at all. By simply being yourself, and you can only be yourself as space consciousness, not as an object. So, anything that goes wrong in your life, a form that appears and you allow it to be, that form becomes an opening into the formless within you. So, your spiritual practice is whenever something goes wrong in your life, and luckily enough, it happens a lot. Not saying that you cannot improve your life. You can improve your life greatly. You can create a much better reality for yourself, which is nice. You can create through applying the power of thought and action and visualization. You can improve your life considerably. You can live in a bigger, more beautiful place, feel better about yourself, and so on. But you cannot escape from the other, from arising. Sooner or later, another polarity, no matter what situation you go into, and I'm not saying you shouldn't improve your life, it's great, but do not expect it to be free of the other polarity, which will arise. Even in the mansion, something will go wrong. And that's what the gossip magazines are all about. The gossip magazines are about things going wrong in mansions. And that makes people feel a little bit better about things going on in their little houses. But it's the same. And they love reading about famous people, things going wrong in their lives. Oh, isn't that great? It's their lives are all collapsing, just like mine. So, one thing that usually happens that when something goes wrong, it pulls you into the old, it strengthens the reactivity of the old mind structures. There's complaining and running away and shouting and fighting. But there's the possibility, when you recognize the little thing, big thing, going wrong, so to speak, that it isn't really wrong, you work with it. You work with it by not resisting the isness of what, of the suchness. Buddha has this beautiful expression, suchness, the suchness. And you work with that rather than resisting it, allowing the suchness of what is right now, the form that this takes. And if the form that this takes should be a limitation, may seem a limitation on your sense of freedom, your freedom of movement, a limitation on what you want to do, a limitation on where you want to get to, and suddenly something rises up in front of you, a door, a wall. You're trying to go that way and suddenly there's a closed door, metaphorically speaking or literally speaking. Once we arrived at a place to give a talk, rented a hall, there was already a long lineup outside. Nobody had the key. And there was nobody there. They had all gone home. So 200 people were lining up. Some were getting angry. I arrived. Can't get in. So you're actually faced with a wall. So what do you then start shouting? No, of course you take action. Can you call somebody? Maybe somebody somewhere has a key and maybe they can come. Okay, somebody did that. But in the meantime, here we are. What was there to do except to cooperate with that moment? So I would just go say, greet everybody in the lineup. And everybody was very happy. And almost by the time I reached the last person, somebody had arrived with a key, as if it had been planned. And now the strange thing is, when you cooperate and allow something to be that initially looks like an obstacle, initially looks like something has gone wrong, and both little and small, when you allow it to be, it becomes an opening into something that you cannot predict what that is. It changes its face from hostile to benign and helpful. The very event that seemed hostile turns around on the external level very frequently. Even more importantly, on an inner level, the shift happens. But you cannot really separate what happens on the outside from what happens on the inside. The inner shift happens, and then the significance of that situation changes also. So that really is the true spiritual practice, is to work with all the little and big things in one's life that seem to be obstacles or blockages. Whatever arises in the now, I'm not talking about some mental formations in the dream world of thinking. Actual obstacles, actual things going wrong, losing this, missing that, meeting somebody and it's the wrong time, it's the wrong place. And don't try to figure out why this has happened. It's very often, more often than not, it's impossible, because you may now think there must be a deeper reason why this has gone wrong. That's a secondary thing. That if you are to know the deeper reason, you will suddenly be staring you in the face. You can't miss it. But in the meantime, you don't even need to figure out what the deeper reason is. It's enough to allow what is to be and then see what happens. It doesn't prevent you from taking action. If you can take action, you take action. But in the meantime, the form that this moment takes is given space to be. And there's the key. Then that which had looked like an obstacle, a blockage, becomes an opening into space consciousness. So the archetypal image of that that humanity has is the cross. And people misinterpret it, and even Christians don't fully understand the deeper significance of the cross, because the cross is the worst thing that could possibly happen. It's an archetype of suffering. The man on the cross is humanity. The cross is the archetype of suffering. The cross is a torture instrument. The cross means complete helplessness, complete extreme pain. But also, it means surrender. Not my will, but thy will be done. Thy will is the will of the whole that has brought about the form that this moment takes. And then surrender happens. And it's strange that the torture instrument is a symbol for the divine at the same time. And it turns into a symbol for the divine through the act of surrender. Somebody once said, I don't know who, but it is very wise, that which stands in the way is the way. And I said in this book, Stillness Speaks, that which seemed to deny the existence of any transcendental dimension to life becomes an opening into that dimension. Because it sometimes happens that a serious illness, a dreadful disaster in your life, something going dreadfully wrong to someone close to you, it seems to deny any meaning. It destroys often people's belief. Christians sometimes have come to me and said, I've lost my faith because this or that has happened to me or to my wife or to my children, my son. And I can't just... How could that happen? They don't realize that they were still at a childish stage in their faith. They had some deal with God. If I do the right things, nothing bad. Okay, do we have a deal? I do all the right things, then nothing bad will happen. But that's not how the universe, because what they're saying is no form will ever dissolve in my life. I will not encounter death or the accidental dissolving of some form. And so they came, and it was good that they lost their faith, because then they went deeper. After losing their faith, they realized that level of faith was childish, although for a while it helped them, and then it didn't work anymore. So they had to lose it and then go deeper to something far more substantial than that, and learn to the deep lesson that is there when you totally accept any form of death in your life? Because very often it is that something dissolves, something leaves you, comes to an end, and it looks bad. And then you allow it to be. Now, you may not be able to allow it to be immediately. The pain that you feel, the emotional pain, may be there, and there's nothing you can do. You weep. But then you allow that to be. It does not matter where you begin to allow what is to be. Ideally, you allow the form that this moment to be as it is totally, and so there's no arising of any pain. But that is not always possible yet for humans. So sometimes an event like the death of somebody close to you, the death of a parent, the death of a sibling, or even more hard, more difficult, the death of a child, it happens. Forms dissolve in their own time. There's no predicting when a life form, the form, will dissolve. And so pain will come. You may weep, and you may experience that's the sadness. And there you can allow that to be, so that it comes to be space around what you feel. There's a deep allowing of the sadness that you feel, and then there's space around it. And that's how you may feel that the sadness, underneath it, you've already touched the peace underneath the sadness. It's already there. But you have to allow the sadness, not saying, I shouldn't be feeling sad, I should be feeling peace. I shouldn't be feeling sad, I should be allowing this moment. No, but that's not the fact of this moment. The fact of this moment is what you feel at this moment. So the yes to what is, the primary yes, is to whatever arises. The secondary yes is the yes to whatever you feel about that which arises. In a smaller example, you're on the road, the car breaks down, a little thing goes wrong, depending what country you're in. In some country, your life may be threatened if you get stranded by the road, or in some big city in North America too, in some parts of big cities. But so it could be a big thing or a relatively small thing. And again, you may succeed in this not so big event to say, that's how it is. And then you face it completely and say, okay, what action can I take? You become still, and then action happens. But it's possible also that you look at the engine and you go, oh, but no, this is not again. And suddenly you become conscious of what you feel, the anger that arises. And then you go, uh-uh. And you, what can you do? You have to, it is what is. At this moment, there's anger. And then comes the secondary allowing. You allow the inner, what is on the inner. You give that space. Because the amazing thing is, whatever emotion is passing through your system, there's always far more space than the emotion. You just have to find it. There's a vast spaciousness in you that is greater than any emotion, that can hold any emotion and allow it to be. It's there. So there's suddenly some space around the anger. You've stepped back from the anger into space. So there's always more space than things in space. You can verify that tonight. The sky is maybe clear tonight, still be clear. And you look up into, you go away from the few lights that there are, so you can simply see vast stars, suns, most of the stars that you see, except for the few planets, are suns at great distances, and you only see a tiny fraction of the infinite vastness of the universe. And when you look, you can see there are two dimensions. There are things in space, and there's space. It's so easy. There are things in space, and there is space. But that which is awe-inspiring about when you look up there is not the things in space. What is awe-inspiring is the vastness of it. Infinite, unimaginable vastness of space. Billions, not just billions of suns, billions of worlds, of galaxies. Each galaxy consists of billions of suns. Vast. And you look, it stops your mind when you truly look. You go, unimaginable vastness. Yes, this, the suns and whatever else is there is beautiful to look at, but that sense of sacredness, of unimaginable vastness, is the space that you look into. And this is just the external version of what is within you. Within you also, because you are only a microcosm, microcosmic version of the universe, in you also there are things, objects in your consciousness, and there is the vastness of consciousness itself, the uncreated. Buddha calls it the unborn, the uncreated, the unformed. He doesn't, and this is so wise to put it like that, because by saying that, it is almost impossible to make it into a mental object. Because the word itself denies itself as an object. It denies itself by saying the unborn. On the one hand, you have a word that is an object in consciousness, but the object in consciousness denies its very existence as an object. This is why the Buddhist teaching is so profound. So he says to his monks, there is, O monks, that's how he addresses his monks in the translation, there is, O monks, an unborn, uncreated, unformed, unmanifested. And then it goes on, it's a little bit stylized sutra. If there were not an unborn, uncreated, unformed, unmanifested, there would be no escape from the world of the born, the created, the formed, and the manifested. Beautiful pointer. So, isn't it amazing that you encounter it not by running away from the world of forms around you, not by attempting to escape the limitations that the world of forms seems to impose on you continuously? And there's this longing for freedom in every human being. And most human beings look at their life situation as a set of limitations around them. It usually is, because every form is limited. Even if you were extremely wealthy, after a while, that would become a limitation on you. You have to have walls around your big house and need bodyguards to go out. So, and then there are the limitations that the body at some point becomes a limitation on you. No matter how fit it is at this moment, eventually you'll grow old, and it may be a little more difficult to get up. Oh, my back hurts. or a more serious limitation. And many limitations happen because form is limitation. And there's a longing in humans for freedom from limitation. Freedom. And people believe that this freedom can be found in some situation. This is not to say that you cannot improve your life situation. It is wonderful to do that. Work to improve your life situation. Live in a nicer place. But not as an believing that that will free you. It's nice because when you play with the world of form, it's nice to have beautiful forms around you if you can, but don't depend on them too much. Because you juggle these forms and then one drops. And then before you know, another one drops. And then somebody throws you one more. Okay. So the escape from limitation is not the escape from the limitations of form in your life. It's through the seeming limitations. By allowing the form of this moment, which quite often seems to be a limitation on your life, by allowing it internally to be as it is. So one could almost say you walk through the limitation, not away from it. You don't run away from it. You face it. And as you face it, allow it to be, it's no longer a limitation. That's inner freedom. So you find inner freedom often in the worst of circumstances people have found it. They found it in prison camps. They found it through serious illness. They found it through serious disability. They found it through loss of all everything that they had and identified with. And suddenly they were driven into acceptance of what is. And then the very limitation around them became an opening. And so some people in prison are living this teaching also. I get more and more letters from people in prison who have become free in prison. And some reported, a couple, that they got released prematurely and they were not even up for parole. Suddenly it happened. But it was a secondary bonus. The miracle is that often a difficult situation, even on the external level, changes and shows a more benign face. But that is a secondary bonus that you get as you surrender. And that it is truly miraculous what you can experience as there's a shift in that consciousness, how quickly an external situation can turn around, how quickly help can come in, because you now cooperate with life, which is now, never not now. You cooperate with this moment. There's no resistance to life, which is now. And then life can help, because the entire universe is a field of intelligence. Nothing is dead. Everything is an expression of that intelligence, that consciousness. It's in the very space in this room. And then it gets, through the human, it becomes focalized, but it's all pervasive. The human is like a magnifying glass that you hold, there's the sunshine, and then you have, it concentrates it. But it's everywhere. And then life becomes helpful in sometimes miraculous ways. Suddenly the right person comes, the right event comes, the right thing comes. But this is what Jesus calls the things that you need will be added unto you. It is secondary. The inner shift is primary. What Jesus describes as finding the kingdom of heaven, which is here now, not over there, some other place, some other time. That is primary, that shift. And then what happens in the world of things is secondary. But miraculously, more often than not, a shift in the world of things will reflect the inner shift. And if it doesn't, the energy that you bring to it will change it. So, in other words, maybe they won't release you yet from prison. Maybe you're still there. And yet you become a factor in that place that usually would be called bad, that is healing and brings enormous help and healing to those around you. There are people who are now teach, who are in prison and teach this already. So they are exactly where they are meant to be. It's amazing how either the situation changes or that which you bring to the situation changes. And so the quality feel of the situation becomes different. And so the work then is, you can now see, to welcome the moment, no matter what form it takes, particularly if it looks not good on the surface. That's where the power, your work, if you can call it work, I don't like that word, but particularly when this work becomes powerful, when applied to all those many events in your life that look not right, wrong, shouldn't have happened, it's not what I want. There you apply becoming friendly with what is. Then the limitation of what is becomes your portal into freedom from the form, your dependency on the forms. Your inner dependency for your sense of who you are, your sense of well-being, of peace, on forms. That goes. And so then you can say what Jesus said, I have overcome the world, he said. People didn't understand what he was talking about. Maybe one or two understood. How can he say, I've overcome the world? He has no power at all. Where's his army? He's powerless. He was talking about the inner realm, dependency on things for his inner state. Because all these, the teachings of humanity, the deep teachings, they do not come from a person. They are nobody's possession or achievement. They come when someone, a person, a human form, becomes transparent in their personal selfhood. The objects become loose and let through space consciousness. Well, there are still some objects in the mind, yes, this and that, but not self-identification with the objects, so they don't form this crust of self that blocks that which is underneath. So it comes through. You become transparent to that spaciousness. And then something comes through you into this world. It may be through words, it may be through action, it may be through a simple invisible emanation of your being that does something to even to this world of things. It changes things here too. It makes it more harmonious, a more benign place to be, a less harsh place. Yes, where polarities still exist, but in a more benign way. In other words, you become an instrument for healing, in a very wide sense of the word, for peace. Peace comes through you into this world. And it is the peace that you cannot understand, that Jesus didn't understand either, because he said, the peace that passes all understanding. So in other words, he didn't understand it either. His mind didn't understand the way it comes from the depth of it. You become a field of peace in this world. It's almost as if something from another dimension came through you into this world of form and affects the world of form. So this is your destiny also, to become that transparency as the crust of identification with mental objects breaks up, dissolves, something shines through. And so in many of you, you already bring, as you go out into the world, you bring peace into situations simply by being there, by not stepping out of the old reactive consciousness. We'll be talking again what that means in relationships in more detail. So when you allow the form that this moment takes to be, your own form, the psychological form of me, becomes somewhat transparent. When you resist the form that this moment takes, your own psychological form, the form of me, becomes more solidified, rigid, impenetrable. And you can actually feel that in yourself. When you go into a situation and you have contraction and resistance, you argue, you won't need to be right. And you can see in that need to argue, to be right, to win, fight, your own, the psychological sense of self contracts and becomes more hardened. The me, you get a stronger sense of self, of stronger sense of who you are. But it's the illusion of who you are. When you can triumph over somebody and show them that you are right and not they, or that you have more than they, or you know more than they, or can do more than they, or you are more miserable than anybody else, it works either way, as long as it's more, you are ill, I've been ill for years. Mind, I have more than you. I may not have more money than you, but I'm more ill than you. And this is the madness of the human condition. When you resist what is, the form hardens the self. And when you allow what is, it softens. And as it softens, it becomes transparent and something shines through that is spacious. You become spacious. And I am sure it also does something even to your physical form, although scientists don't know, haven't discovered what that is. Maybe they haven't examined a surrendered human being yet. Maybe they haven't heard about it yet. And as humanity begins to live in this way, or a larger part of humanity, of course, it is likely that the physical organism will also undergo changes. Perhaps there'll be even more space than there's already. Already you consist of 99% empty space. Scientists know that. The atoms, the space between the atoms that make up your body is so vast that you are more than 99% empty space. In Zen Buddhism, they have Satori. Satori is a sudden flash, a sudden realization. Not always lasting, but it's there, sometimes accompanied by shouting or laughter. And then you have the Chinese fat Buddha who never stops laughing. Continuous Satori. Tomorrow evening, when it comes, of course, it won't be tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, I believe there's a film that you can go and see that is a very good film. It's called Fierce Grace, about the life of Ram Dass and his stroke and how that changed him and the meaning of adversity and pain. It's kind of illustrates also what we have been addressing here. Also, if any questions need to be asked, there is no, by the way, not, don't want to devalue questions. No question, however, is ultimately vital. Many questions arise from the mind, but there are some questions that you feel you truly need to know the answer to, and it may not have yet come through you. If you become still enough, the answer to any question, the answer if you need it, it'll come through you. But if there should be questions, you can write them on a little piece of paper and leave them. There may be a basket or something like that there tomorrow, after the session tomorrow. And I'll look through them, and maybe a few will jump out and address them. A few will maybe questions that are very helpful to everybody, and questions that are purely mental, I may not have time to answer, nor may I have the answer to them. For example, can you describe the lives of the future Buddhas? Or who were the past Buddhas? Or what about the life on planet so-and-so? It's not vital to know that right now for your liberation. So use whatever the moment presents, both the beauty that is out here and anything else that may happen. They are all openings. The beauty, too, is an opening. The beauty that you see, the beauty that you listen to. Remember what we started with today? Enter Zen from there, from this moment, whatever it is. Pay attention, be alert, watch. If you resist this moment, you cannot be attentive to what is. Remember to work with the sounds. Bring awareness to the sounds around you. And sense the awareness itself as yourself. So you are that awareness, you are that consciousness, and the personal appearance, the appearance of you as a person, is a temporary disguise of consciousness. Hide and seek. Let's pretend that I'm a human, a person. Oh, that'll be fun. And let's play some dramas. Yes, but for the dramas, you have to forget completely who you are. Okay, then let me forget completely who I am and play the drama. And then you get tired of the drama after a few hundred thousand years. And then after we've played, let's wake up. Oh. Thank you. Thank you.
This concludes Lesson 3. Lesson 4, A Day Spent in Silence.
The bells returned to the manifested realm. Refreshed. The ringing of the bells traditionally is a spiritual wake-up call. Preceded usually by the alarm clock. That's another kind of waking up. As we are speaking of waking up, I hope the people in Austin and Hollyhock are fully awake also. They are over there where the camera is. I'm sorry you have to get up so early. But you're here. This is the day that we spend in silence. Except for this person up here. Well, not really. Although the words are there, there's still the dimension of silence, of stillness, is present. More important than the words. So if you can be attentive to both the words and, more importantly, that which is between the words, which to the mind is nothing. And indeed it is no thing. And yet it's an energy field. The wonderful thing is, you cannot become attentive to that without the same field of stillness being activated within you. The very fact that you notice the silent gaps in between words or in between sentences means the very same silence, the very same stillness at that moment is in you also. Otherwise, you wouldn't even notice it. And you may also be surprised to find that in the moment of noticing the silent gap, you are not thinking. You may also find, if the gaps become too long, you notice it at first, and then you start thinking again. That's okay. Or you may not. But that is the most significant thing that can happen to you in this lifetime, on this planet, where you've taken temporary form as a so-called person. So of course, you are consciousness. The most significant thing is this cessation of thinking without loss of consciousness. From our normal perspective, the perspective of the normal everyday mind, the perspective of thought, it looks like there's nothing there. There's nothing there that can be grasped or understood. And yet it's the ground of all being, the very ground of your existence. Existence is the manifested. Being, the way I use these words, is the unmanifested life that you are. Underneath the form, the background, we can also call it. So, to be aware here, continuously, of the background to all this, the field of stillness, the field of aware presence, of self-aware stillness. And also be aware of that which arises in the stillness. Words, sense perceptions, bodily sensations. But to have your roots, to be grounded in the stillness, and here, all you have to do is be aware of the gaps between the words. Now, there's something that cannot be manufactured, something that needs already to be there in you. A readiness, the ability even to be aware of the gaps. We could call that ability alertness. And that's the true meaning of waking up out of the dream of thought, of being identified with a continuous stream of thought. So, most of you, or almost everyone here, has this ability already. There's enough presence in you so that you can notice, be aware of the silent spaces. And in that awareness, the awareness of the silent space, really, what is a silent space? It's the absence of something. Where before there was a word, the word has returned, the sound has returned into nothingness. Before there was something, now there is nothing. So this, what is the silent space? It's the absence of something, of the thingness of life. So when we say you are aware of the silent space, it's a strange way of putting it. It works as a pointer. But what does that really mean? You are aware, first you are aware of a word. Your attention is on the word. Then the word disappears. And it is not replaced by inner words arising in you, because attention remains. The word disappears. And so when we say you are now aware of the gap, what's really happening is you have become self-aware. Awareness or consciousness has recognized itself. Without it, the object is gone. Just the field of bare attention remains. And that is a realm of also of great peace, the silent peace that's always there in the background. And as you realize that, it seems to become stronger. It seems to grow inside you. That's probably a perspective only, but it seems to grow and become stronger. So as you sit here, you don't grow in knowledge very much, except a few Zen stories or something. But you grow in awareness. However, any words that we use to describe it are already somewhat misleading. Perhaps a better way of putting it is to say that as you sit here, you shrink. The person shrinks. The personal sense of self that's identified with thought diminishes, and something else emerges. So. And so I've pointed out before, maybe not here, this is not a personal development group. Sometimes I say that when I arrive at the airport and the immigration officer says, "What are you going to do here? What do you teach?" In order to reach him at all, I sometimes say personal development and know that it's not true. But if I said personal shrinkage, he wouldn't let me in. No, the person remains, but what gradually happens is there comes a shift. The transcendent dimension in you becomes stronger than the personal. The personal can still be used. Your name. The conventions that are to do with the way of interacting with others. But more and more something else flows into that. And we could call that stillness, but not stillness as just an absence of noise, but stillness as an alive presence. So stillness flows into your sense perceptions. It flows into your looking. That's why if you've been looking at things in nature and realize that it becomes so much more alive when you don't label or interpret it. So it flows into your looking. So the stillness is also attention. It's a stream, one could call it a current of awareness. Where before there was thought, very different energy frequency thought. When you approach anything or perceive anything through thought, very different frequency. You can see when you look at a person whether he or she is perceiving you through thought or through stillness. Or when a person is looking at something, you can see whether they are classifying it, interpreting it, finding some kind of personal relationship to it. People do that with trees and flowers too. Some people have the compulsion to pick flowers because they need to enter into a personal relationship with a flower, not realizing that they could be in a much deeper relationship if they went beyond the personal that says, I would like to have that. Or even if you don't pick it, you might think, how would that look in my garden, in my backyard? Or have some kind of comparison to it. Put it in some kind of comparative category. It's not even necessarily to do with yourself, but it's still I overheard a man saying he was looking at the sun, at the sky after sunset, or was it after sunrise? Just that. And he said to his companion, look at that Turner sky. Turner is a British artist who lived, I believe, in the 19th century, who painted beautiful paintings of light, sky, and just light. And finally, he was looking, but it also had to be compared to something. You can look more deeply if you don't classify and compare it to anything. And it is likely that Turner himself looked at the sky in the state of complete open presence with reference to nothing else, not to another word, to a word or anything else. And sometimes you find people who are walking in nature and it's beautiful, and lush. But the mind comes in, and for a moment they look, and then they say to you, "Yeah, oh, you should go to Hawaii. It's even more lush there." And then they start telling you about Hawaii while you carry on walking. So this current of awareness flowing through you into your sense perceptions, your seeing, your hearing, but it also flows as a kind of emanation, because every human being has a certain emanation. Now, most humans have the emanation of mind, and many humans, in addition, have the emanation frequently of pain body. And many humans have a very nervous emanation, tense. Where's the next thing? They want to get to the next thing and at the same time feel threatened by the next thing that's going to come. So that's what they emanate with their whole being. And that's the entire civilization. To a large extent, big cities have that energy field that's generated by millions of people. There are certain other countries where at first it feels, there's less nervousness here. But then you realize they're actually, the energy field, although it may not be nervous, is a little sleepy. Instead of going beyond thought, they are drifting below thought. And so you tend to see lots of people sitting or lying around street corners in a state of semi-sleep. And yes, it feels, if you come just arrived from New York, it feels great for a while. And you also sometimes find human beings who seem to be more peaceful. And you yourself may find that in certain situations or conditions, you're not as nervous after a few drinks, after taking this or that substance. And it's great, it can, is a glimpse of what it means not to be thinking, that how alive you can feel. But in many of these cases, when you've taken a few drinks, yes, you're beginning to step out of thought and you feel better. Oh, that feels good, I must have another drink. Oh, let's have another. And before you know it, you're going towards unconsciousness and sleep. Yes, you have stepped out of the stream of thinking, but have stepped, one could say, in evolutionary terms, you're stepping back.
Lesson 4, continued on Disc 5.